I was stationed at the Camp Carl Sargent, one of those 4,000, I guess, military personnel that worked actually in a civilian capacity. When I got there, I was... Are you getting everything? When I got there, I was placed as an assistant to Helmut Gottlob and was made... My duties were primarily antennas in those days. And the reason was that I had majored in RF and communications. And so I was responsible for upkeep and design and development of ground antennas, which were used for the cutoff radio command system, as well as for the rather primitive, telemetry system. Also, I was involved in the tune-up of the tail antenna. They had to be tuned prior to final assembly, or during the final assembly in the hangar near the test stand, prior to firing. So I had to be available at odd hours, maybe at midnight or 2 in the morning, to tune those down antennas just at the moment when they just had the tail in the right position so I could tune those.
Do you know any specific stories or anecdotes that might be
Not at this point, no.
Other than that, were not anecdotes.
But that the method they used was rather archaic.
No, tell me about that.
They had a tripod with a field strength meter, sort of a loop antenna, and they excited the antennas by a test oscillator at the proper frequency. And then they had about 3 foot long screwdriver made out of a special material like lucite, low loss material, low capacity. And so with that screwdriver you were supposed to tune for maximum field strength. This was almost impossible in the hangar because the vehicle was placed in inside of a steel structure. I mean, there were a lot of, metal around there, and there were many reflections, and you could never really get a good tune-up or tuning of the antenna. And so I got involved in changing all this. And in order to do that, I tried several methods. I was working properly. I became acquainted with Dr. Helfer, who had originally come from Telefunken, and he was familiar and in love with the famous Rosenstein bridge, which was an impedance measuring device, which he suggested I should use. That, however, had too many handicaps also, because it required special made cables for each frequency, a new cable, and that was very cumbersome. And so I abandoned that idea, and then I became acquainted with Dr. Muller. Have you got Dr. Muller on your list? Well, anyway, Dr. Muller was more of a practically oriented man, and tried to do things as simple as possible, and he influenced me to use an entirely different method of tuning these antennas. And he suggested to use a resonance method with a simple crystal detector to just worry about the radiation of the antenna, but just feed the antenna to the test oscillator and then just for a minimum adjustment on that maximum, I forgot, on the little crystal detector. And in fact, that was became finally the mass production test method. So that just was one little phase of that. And then I was involved in this was a very short time, because from February 43 till August 28th, when we had the big attack, the air raid, I was right under that also, one of the main soldiers.
Could you describe that a little bit about that?
And
the damage to your areas and so forth?
Well, fortunately, the camp, which had about 4,000 soldiers, was very little affected, particularly the incendiary bombs did not hit us, so there was no fire. But we were all in dirt trenches, and I remember specifically the trench I was in behind the barracks collapsed when the bomb hit real nearby, probably about 20 feet from it. And I was up to my shoulders in the dirt, and so was my neighbor, and so we had no utensils, except our fingers, to dig ourselves out for quite a while.
Well, how deep were you in?
Well, I'm standing probably like this, and up to here. And there was another guy underneath that my neighbor pointed out, and we got him out to laugh by, you know, digging down. Well, this was 80 minutes of arrow. That was something. Anyway, prior to that, around, Labor Day, I mean, 1st of May, rather. Is that Labor Day?
My 1st of September.
No, I mean, not Labor Day. I mean,
May Day.
May Day, but it was Labor Day in Germany.
Oh, it was. That's
1st of May. The day of the national labor.
Yeah, that's
May Day.
Yeah.
Yeah. Tag National Labor. Anyway, around that period, I had to put the final specifications, come up with final specifications on the tail antenna, the all tail antenna, so that we could for mass production. And that had to be done in a hurry. They wanted to start the so-called zero theory, which was mass production theory that they, of 100, I believe, that they did right there in 2 minutes. Of course, that was bombed out. But anyway, I suggest we've been doing this in about 4 weeks or something like that. And I have spent about 2 weeks of testing the antennas at the beach. And so, that's what the secretary and I said. It's the two of us. I mean, it was going to be done rather fast. Again, there I used numerous methods, particularly the substitution method of receiving, and it went rather fast. Thanks to that. Otherwise, it wouldn't have made it. So that was about my last test, I guess, it was the mass production certification. So, in other words, closely with Mr. Burns' design group.
Where were these items produced, actually?
In Kenya?
Yeah.
Well, I think they were produced somewhere in India.
In a
small company. I've forgotten the name of that. But I was involved in some of those design changes and, you know, the things that come up.
Well, these were now delivered when you began to mass produce the V2 down in the Harz Mountains.
I was not involved in any of that.
No, but were these antennas then delivered directly to that assembly?
I'm sure they were, but since I wasn't involved in it, I was not in the production.
Right. What I'm interested in is to find out as the war drew to a close, how these supplies were able to continue to feed into the production there.
No, that's just something that somebody else needs to ask.
Yeah. I talked to Art Rudolph a great deal. Sometimes it's just, if you have a particular story or...
No.
Yeah, all kinds of things.
I believe that. Right. He's a good talker and has a lot more, has seen a lot more, you know, in the big picture.
But I thought perhaps you might have some examples of difficulties you had, but again, you said you...
No, naturally we had material difficulties, and I remember specifically I was also involved in the RF cabling of the vehicle, and particularly what cable to select and then on the ITDY, and the first two building systems that cable manufacturer, you know, and buy a cable, and stuff like that. I mean, you know, that's
the developmental
cycle. That's right. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, this was a very short span, as I said already, from February to August. Then the big air raid came, and shortly after the air raid, maybe only 2 or 3 weeks, that we were the first on the island. We were then in Putagla, you may have heard that name. Okay. Well, anyway, in Putagla, I was only for a short while. I don't remember how long. Maybe been only 2 or 3 weeks. And that must have been about the time when Brown and Dressup had been arrested. Because I remember distinctly that Dressup was sitting in Dr. Steiner's headquarters there in Puttigua under a constant SS guard. And the strangest thing that I never understood was that Dressup, who became the leader of the group in Russia, had been my boss, you know. Of course, that changed then after that. But he was given the assignment to collate all the research results, the catalog, and you know, organize all the file. And as God.
Yeah.
It makes me sometimes a little bit wondering whether that wouldn't happen considerably later on in reconstructing all this thing when he went over there.
Right, I wonder. Yeah, I talked to him last year.
You did?
I had dinner with him.
Oh,
in Munich. He's in Munich now.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he has his own data processing.
The last time I saw him was in 55, when I went to check the Germany then, the first time, after my mother had died. And that was the time when we were under secret service Larry, when the other kids were still there, and I went to see Brother. But I was in the book out there. Anyway, from Peter Gar, a group, a small group of about 12 people, I believe, under Balchino, I mentioned Balchino already, went to Dresden, to the University, Technical University of Dresden. Now, at the University of Dresden, there was Professor Luhmann, whose name you have heard of, who's the developer, or his group developed the Doppler system.
Yes.
And now it was in Dresden where they had also, near Dresden, they had a shop where they outfitted trucks with all this equipment to be used at the front. And of course the university laboratories were used to do the finishing touches on the development and modification. So anyway, this group under Balchino went to Dresden and was taken there, and I was asked to go along. It was all sort of a spur of the moment, I think, to take care of the antenna end of it. I had been in Dresden just a short while. I don't remember how long. It may have been no more than a week. When Balchino, who was, by the way, the first lieutenant then, received a telegram from Heidelager, General Dornberger, and he was to report the amnesia. And he just sort of turned around to me and said, "You just take over."
No.
So, therefore, I took over and had to be the liaison man between Dr. Kirchstein, who was then in charge of this area, this RF area, and Professor Luhmann. And I did this for approximately 3/4 of a year. And I was allowed to wear civilian clothes and live in a civilian quarters, which was nice. So that was the time where I met Kampmeyer. Now, have you got Kampmeyer on your list? And during this 3/4 of a year of liaison in Dresden, I met Heinz Kampmeyer, who was then working on the cutoff and combustion cutoff radio command transmitter system at Siemens. Siemens built the transmitter for that purpose. And I also met Carl Schindler, who was in charge of the actual installation of the of all the radio command cutoff as well as Doppler equipment in the trucks. Mm-hmm. So I don't want to go into a lot of details unless I have to.
Well,
I mean,
you have anything you think is particularly
important? I mean, I missed the attack, the famous or infamous attack on Dresden, fortunately, for myself.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I missed that. I don't remember. I must have returned shortly before that.
Mm-hmm.
But I did not go back to Peenemünde itself.
Where did you go afterwards?
I went from there to Lubmin.
Mm-hmm.
You know where that
no.
is? That's on the mainland.
Mm-hmm.
Well, after the Dresden period, I went back, I went to Lubmin, near Peenemünde, on the mainland. And in Lubmin, since the outfit was at this time highly dispersed, all the ground equipment was being developed. That means the mobile ground equipment, all the outfitted for the troops.
The mylar
lighting? That part I don't know, but all the ground measurement, ground, you know, the radio stations.
Oh, I
see. Okay. The development center was really there. See, I had been embracing to do this, to aid in the tricky outfitting of these stations because the developers were embracing. But you might say the overall planning center was in the room. And this was under Mr. Huberg. You know that? And Mr. Gengelbach.
With
Steve in at
12:30.
Okay, let's see.
He's from the West Coast.
So I stayed there until February 44.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had, as it was customary, 3 days military leave, just left in the army. to Yosemite Pass because Mecklenburg, my hometown, had been bombed out. It was in the first severe area and burned down the whole town. And so I went to Mecklenburg in February with three day leave. Do you want to stop this here? Well, anyway, so I went there, and this was the time when the Russians got real close to Pinamonda. In fact, it was the time when the Russians were back at Stettin.
Mm-hmm.
So, after those 3 days of solo, and I came back to Pinamonda, or in order to get back, the Mecklenburg was on the main rail line to Berlin. And from Berlin, we had to take another train up north, you know, to usually through Stettin to get to Pinamonda, but that was no longer possible. So here I was in Berlin in the waiting room at the railroad station called the Stettiner Bahnhof. And I noticed a lot of sergeants roaming around, and for some accidental reason, it was just one of those points where fate comes in, you know. I was sitting together with a master sergeant from the Air Force. He was a really friendly guy. Usually the Army Air Force was sort of in a way, they didn't seem what I mean. One thought they were better than the other. And this master sergeant pointed this out to me. You know what those sergeants are doing? They are trying to correct people for the last thing, for the last position, for the list. You just stay with me. I got some ammunition to carry, and you help me with that. And we go through the tunnel, and that's a, state. Which we did, and that, I think, saved me at that point, because I was supposed to go back to Munich. So then I took a train further west, because the one through Stettin was no longer possible, it was already cut by the Russians. And now I took a train to Lübeck, which is further west. And then another, I think, a freight train over to Rosen, or Greifswald, I believe, and it's one of the other. And from there, on a narrow gauge train to Lubmin. And when I got to Lubmin, everybody was packing and burning secret documents. So I guess it was the next day or the after that I left again. And we moved by truck.
This is your whole group now?
Yeah.
So what was this group called this time?
Well, of course, I was with BSM.
That was the BSM group. Were they all, most of them that now congregated there? It's
funny,
it's a dispersal of all.
Well, I can't picture that exactly anymore.
Anyway, you
had
a group of you at
Lemay. Yeah.
Got ready to move.
Moved out. And we used those parts that were, you know, topics with instrumentation. We used them for transportation.
Mm-hmm.
And moved on out. And
could you explain your moving out, how you moved out, what routes you took? Do you remember that?
No, I don't remember that, unfortunately, except that we went to Mecklenburg again, where I just had been.
Oh, boy.
So we came back, passed Mecklenburg, and went to the area of Breitenwalde.
Oh yeah, okay, right down here.
Mm-hmm. And we went through that area, and we dispersed over that area. And
tell me a little bit about your stay, how the travel was. Did you get through
that
when you bombed?
No problems whatsoever.
You went right to
Blackerode. That's right, we didn't stop either.
So what did you do when you got to
Blackerode? In Blackerode, we were dispersed in the outlying small towns and villages.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I was in either growth or crime building, something like that. That's where all these strong stations were. Remember, they'd be an outfit.
Yeah,
that's true. And you know, if you want to look at that mountain, see that? So anyway, I was stationed in a small village about 3 miles from Blackerode, and we acted like nothing happened, and we kept continuing our development, strangely enough, you know, product improvement, that is.
Mm-hmm.
But it got hotter and hotter.
You unloaded your trucks?
Yeah, we built up a little laboratory in the schoolhouse and kept going.
In the schoolhouse? Now, let's say that schoolhouse is in what town?
I think it was Klein Bodering.
Okay.
It was about 3 miles from Blackerode.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't know the direction, it made them more simple. Anyway,
yeah.
But it got pretty warm here after a while, after a few days, because the American planes came here, and they started strafing and bombing.
Did they know you were there?
I don't know that.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, after I'd been there for, I don't know exactly, maybe 3 weeks or so, orders reached my company command that I was supposed to just pack up and leave. And I didn't say why. And then, of course, to pack up and leave and go to Lazarus. When I got there, I found out that a friend of mine who was working higher up in headquarters, his name's the director, was helping us make up these lists of priority. Who goes to the United States first? Now, remember, this was in February or March, something like that. February or March 1944. So they made up list number one, number two, as to who would go to America.
In 44?
Yeah.
I mean 45.
No, 44. I'm sorry.
No, 45.
Wait a minute. 45, yeah. Did I get that in the
quick? Yeah, 45.
I mean, this whole thing. Wait. Anyway, I stayed in Blackwood Odom one night, and incidentally, the friend of mine was Dr. Svidetsky. I don't know if he had him on the list. And he was assistant to Dr. Kirstein. And in fact, I stayed in Dr. Kirstein's office that night and burned all the glass by talking.
No.
Anyway, the next day, they outfitted that famous plane. And incidentally, I was placed on list number one. You to come over. Anyway, So we left the train, bypassing all the major air raids. No problem, but they'll have a few stops, you know, when trains go near them. Mm-hmm. Went by train all the way to Oberammergau.
Could you tell a little bit about the train trip, just a detail of how you got on the train and what you were, all you can think about in that train trip?
I'm sorry, I cannot really give you a lot of details on that. All I know is that Lintner, the late Chuck Lintner, have you got him on this? Of course, he's deceased.
The one who died in Fort Bliss?
No, he died here for heart attack.
Oh, well, he confirmed that.
Well, anyway, on this train, there were certain people put in charge, like, for instance, Lieutenant Lintner. And it was funny. One time we had an air alarm, and the train stopped, and people wanted to run out of the train, and he would wave his gun around, and, you know, people who showed themselves, you know, because the planes must get interested, you know, this kind of stuff. But anyway, near Munich, Gorkos apparently jumped the train. Now, this thing recorded elsewhere. And so we got to Oberammergau, and to our great horror, that Oberammergau, this was famous passion play town, if you remember, we went into some kind of Air Force Research Center or something. But anyway, this was under heavy SS. I mean, Oberammergau was just black, it was SS. I mean, it seems like it was some kind of Air Force, somebody else might know that. Research center there where we were supposed to stay, and there were conflicting rumors, you know, whether we're going to be shot or whether we're going to be put to work or something to the same thing, I don't know. But anyway, it was very uncomfortable with the thousands of the ass women all over town, and our management decided, by word of mouth, you know, to everybody, let's get pushed into an area of circle of maybe, I don't know, 50 miles from Uganda. Which we did after a couple of days or so, and that's probably recorded elsewhere else. We probably hit this first. So we did this first into many villages. I personally was found a temporary home in Hohenteichenberg. Now that in that little town, I went by wagon in 55.
No.
And found the old place. It changed slightly. The people who stayed were still there, but they didn't recognize me, naturally. Anyway, I was stationed at the building which housed the sheriff of the town. And also the country store, you might say. So that the country store was downstairs, and the sheriff was the next door, and I had an attic room. Now, here comes a little story, if you wish.
Okay.
Well, Svidetsky was in that same town, too, by the way, in the little other. Is that one?
Yeah,
this
one's second.
Well, anyway, in Hohenteichenberg, or every one of us that was in the first into the village was to get away from the earth, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Which was a good thing. There was enough confusion that we could do that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
We're just waiting patiently for the American army to overrun the place. Okay?
Okay.
Now, in fact, I remember distinctly that on the 20th of April, that was Hitler's birthday, they had a big white radio broadcast, and the infamous, or famous infamous, Goebbels was given a big old speech like everything was okay and I was listening to the lady, basically in the kitchen of the people who stayed. And shortly thereafter, the American troops moved into town.
Mm-hmm.
There was some SS in town, temporarily, which fortunately left, because they stayed in some other towns and started blowing up bridges and caused a lot of trouble that way, because there was really no point in holding it up any further.
Mm-hmm.
So they left, fortunately. So here the troops came, and their first great deed was, I mean, the American troops, to set free the Russian workers in the coal mines. About 100 of them, and they all obtained nice blue suits, and they had a red flower in a buttonhole, and they were given 3 days of free shopping. Now you can imagine that thing. Somehow the people were saved, and I guess probably due to the sheriff or something, I don't know, we got wind up that early, I mean before it happened, after the Americans had occupied the town. And so I suggested to the people that we barricade many of the entrances that they had. They had a cow barn next to the building, and there were entrances everywhere, and entrances to the basements and all kinds of stuff. So we get better control of who goes where. So we used logs and everything, barricaded everything except 2 entrances.
Okay.
But here the Russians came flooding into the country store, naturally.
Mm.
And it was very strange, very funny. Whether it was one of the Russians or somebody else, I do not know. Claimed there was an SS living in the house. They meant me, because I've never been here. So they threw the MP that, you see. And so the MP fired a few shots into my attic while I was downstairs in the kitchen. Trying to keep track of the Russians that were through shopping. And I was all this time. And I all this time, although I was still a soldier, I was wearing an old shabby suit of Scottish cadetry that really became a mixed blessing, I'll tell you in a minute. Now, in this case, it was a blessing because I looked like anybody else, and nobody suspected me. In fact, when it got too bad with the Russians, and they got into all kinds of other rooms and tried to go upstairs and what have you, I noticed that one of the American officers spoke German, and I just took it upon myself to ask him if he wasn't kind of restrict the Russians from flooding all over the house and confine them to the shopping area, which he did.
Mm.
And they looked all over where they found my gas mask and my uniform somewhere, so this was pretty regular, obviously. But nobody found me. I was just out there with them, you see.
Mm.
And so in this sense, I mean, the suit helped me quite a bit, and I wasn't up in the attic either when they shot into it. So this thing was going over after a couple of days, anyway. So then, soon after what passed along, the group that the army had decided to internalize in Garmisch, and that they had set up collection points at different places, like a little restaurant next to the place where I stayed at a certain day, a certain time, where the talks would come and take us to Garmisch. Okay? So here's where the mixed blessing of the two comes in. So here I get all my little knapsack or suitcase, all I had. And we walk up to this little restaurant in civilian clothes, the old threadbare suit from tradition, and walk up to that MP. He wanted to find an identification, so I take out my soldier books, that's what we call it, the soldier's pants, you see, because that's all I had. He said, what? Soldier? Civilian? Boom! Whereupon I gave him a real big smile to the MP. And told him, well, I'm one of those engineers that are supposed to collect you at this point. He said, and he tapped me on the shoulder and he smiled himself, and forgot all about boom boom, you see. Which, because mainly these type of things happened to many others, they were carted off to prison camps.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to avoid that. No, you had to rather quick.
I see.
So anyway, I waited in there until we were transported to guns. Now, in Garmisch, of course, you probably heard about that from other books, about the many interrogations and things like that. I wasn't too much involved since there was just a small number. That was, in a way, really a gay time, actually. Built me a little idea. That was funny. The American troops would come to the windows knowing that they were specialists. They found that out somehow. They would come from the suicide to the windows of the room and ask if we would fix their radio that they had confiscated somewhere.
Uh-huh.
So in the process of that, I obtained a few parts and I built my own radio. Out of the
car. Very good.
Well, it's an extra part that we found inside the building in the basement, uh-huh. like the roof and stuff. So anyway, I built my radio during the thing.
Uh-huh.
A lot of people did lots of things, like Hooker wrote a play, a detective play, which was very well performed.
Mm-hmm.
He was one of the actors, actually. Another group formed a band,
mm-hmm.
and you probably know about all this, and many of them started lectures like mathematics, languages,
mm-hmm.
and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
How
were you all living in there? Do you have a little private rooms or any barracks?
No. This was a permanent building, and this is now a sort of a staff or administration building in Gomez. In fact, in 1955, I went to this building again.
Oh.
With that secret service man.
Mm-hmm.
And I was then had a kiosk, and I don't know.
What was it called, that building?
No, I don't know. It was somebody else in my
Okay. Was it right downtown?
Yes. It was a big building, about 4 or 5 stories.
Mm-hmm.
Had the hardwood floor, central heating, equipment, and everything. It's a nice building.
And all of the group were in there? I mean, there
yes.
Group,
all of
the
Tom Brother was there.
Yeah.
Okay. So anyway, what was I going to say? Oh, during this period, I started learning English, thinking I might need that, you see.
Mm.
We hadn't signed any contracts there
at
that time, but that was my word of mouth. It was pretty powerful, you know.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't need speak English.
Mm-hmm.
So Mr. Byrne, whom you also want to talk to, and several others and I think it was 4 of us, got together and formed a little English club where we learned as we could.
Did you talk to the Americans at all?
No, I couldn't talk yet, you know.
No, but did you have any opportunity to practice with them?
No, no. Nothing.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't really much have a starting point, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, what we did, we had I think Mr. Byrne or somebody had a little lesson book, a primitive one, like first grade or something, I don't know. It had little kick stories in it, like about little rabbits. So I had heard somewhere that it's a good way to learn a language is to memorize a story, so I started memorizing the stories and memorize it, regular words, and start little books, notebooks with vocabulary, and get this practice all the way until I finally came to this country. So I had a little background.
But made the basic plans for the selection? You remember who selected those who come to America?
Yeah, that was always in a sense pre-selected.
You didn't list it.
Yeah, we existed. Now,
do you know who did that? Who was primarily involved in
it? Wilson Brown. All the directors.
All the directors.
Yeah.
I suppose he selected those people they considered.
In order to get a cross-section. They wanted to get a cross-section of every kind.
Except the brokers and everybody who was offered a job came to America.
Yeah, no, wait. Now, this was the period in Gomez, right?
Yeah.
And I don't know, I'm probably telling you much too much stuff.
No.
In any detail. Part of us from Gomez, since the British had to be given something also, you know, from over to England. Part of us, we're taking the Cook's house now.
Tell me about that.
And so that was done by truck, you know, along the Autobahn. It was sort of fun. And so we got there and lived in barracks there. And I wasn't too much involved in the actual planning. I was more involved in procuring material.
Mm.
There was an interpreter and I that went to Hamburg several times.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I had to sleep and stay at the police station since I wasn't supposed to run around sea, right?
Mm-hmm.
And still wearing my old shabby suit.
You still have that suit?
No. That is important. Anyway, so that was interesting thing. You know. There wasn't too much to do except for those that really knew how to fire up and
mm-hmm. get. How did the British treat you? Was there a big difference between the American and British?
Yes, much more strict, much more formal. In fact, at one point, of course, this was somewhat understandable. They chased everybody out of the barracks and we had to stand in line, you know, in the court outside the barracks. And the British MP let through everything. I remember they were, Bert Dr. Helter had a book like that was locked, I guess, and they stopped opening the padlock. What they were looking for was General John Bird at that. Well, all the while, Bossinger had hidden that in a chicken coop in another camp near Cuxhaven where part of our group was.
Okay.
So that thing just came to this country and was never captured earlier.
And where is it now? Dornberger has it now?
I don't know, I suppose so. But anyway,
how did he happen to get it from Dornberger?
Well, he was his accident.
Yeah, and Dornberger gave it to him, said he hide it, or?
Wasn't
Dornberger pretty more of a prisoner as well?
Right, thought he was.
He gave it to Dornberger.
Must have been. Now, I wasn't involved in that. Now, this kind of information you need to get from Oscar, you know?
Yeah.
So anyway, that was hidden in Cuxhaven, you see. And the British were after this thing. They never found it. Something. Anyway, so we had been there only a few weeks, and then American planes came there, fortunately, to carry us to Middle Germany, where the families had in the meantime been moved to. I didn't mention, although that didn't...
That's the Landshut you're talking about now?
No, that'd be fast. There was an area near Breitenwald. It was on the other side of the Iron Curtain.
Wittgenhausen?
Eschwegen, Wittgenhausen, yes. And Kirchhoff was there too, with his family. And I remember one night I was taking a ride in Steiner's car. It was him driving like a wild one, you know, he was very fast driving. And he just suddenly turns around and says, "Is it true that Kirchhoff went across the German border to the Russians?" I said, "Well, I've read the one."
Was about 4 pounds of flesh were divided among 28 people, each obtaining one slice of flesh, which was besides a cup of soup, which was prepared from dehydrated vegetables, water, was the only additional nourishment we received. Badly enough, the soup was not even spiced with salt, since at this time salt was not available at all. Soon you had used up your reserves and got extremely hungry. There was grass around the back. We picked laurel leaves and other small plants and roots to supplement our diet. There was really no way of making any contact if you were once inside the camp. There were fences of barbed wire, were placed around the camp, watchtowers, and bright lights made an escape impossible. Nobody could approach the fence from the outside.